Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is Constance Baumgardner-McGee, author of Higher Education, Marijuana at the Mansion, a story of power, politics, and just plain bad manners at the uppermost echelons of university life, as told by the former First Lady of three American universities. Constance, welcome to my show.
Thank you, Nate. But may I add one little thing? It's not Muggy, it's Gee.
Oh, Gee. Did I do that? I'm sorry. I lived on a street called McGee.
McGee's no. Nice. I like it. But that's
oh, my God. I have Gee written all over here. I'm sorry. I used to live on that street. I was born on that street. Oh, my God. I can't believe I said that.
At least it's not Magoo.
No, it's not Magoo. It's Constance Baumgardner Gee. Okay. Let's go. This book was a chronicle of your life as the first lady of three major universities, and also your journey with a debilitating disease, Meniere's disease. What made you write this book? How did this book come about?
I really needed to write this book in order just to get on with my life. I don't know if you've ever. I'm sure you have been through something and you just keep ruminating about it and thinking about it over and over, and things begin to come more clearly for me when I write something, when I write it out. And so I began to write the book to sort of understand what had happened over the course of my 13-year marriage, and also because I had so many people after. Well, we'll probably have to go back and explain to the audience, but after, as I say, my pratfall from grace, when I was actually outed on the front page of the Wall Street Journal for smoking pot in the Vanderbilt Chancellor's residence, I had so many people ask me, why didn't you speak out about medical marijuana when you had the chance? Why didn't you speak out about Meniere's disease? Mm-hmm. And so I really felt a need not only to have some cathartic means of understanding what had happened, but also I felt a responsibility to speak out about Meniere's disease and about medical marijuana.
Okay, good. You briefly mentioned your life being plastered on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. In 2006, the Wall Street Journal did an article, some sort of an expose, that accused you or outed you as having marijuana in the governor's mansion. I'm not sorry, in the president's.
The governor's mansion. That would have been fun.
I've already elevated you to another level there. No, I have marijuana.
Nice, thank you.
At Vanderbilt University, tell us about that article and what was the fallout from that article.
Oh well, the article was originally, I think, put together, it was supposed to be on how universities were dealing with the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation, and that had to do with corporate governance.
Mm-hmm.
So that was ostensibly what the article was supposed to be about, and so they were looking at, and they spent about 5 months in Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to talking to people to try to uncover any dirt on my former husband, Gordon Gee, who is now the president of Ohio State, in terms of was there any malfeasance in terms of the way that Vanderbilt was run. And there was none. They found nothing because there wasn't anything. Gordon is extremely above board in all of that. And so there wasn't really anything much to show for 5 months of sleuthing by two Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists at the Wall Street Journal, except for that somebody was more than happy to tell them during this five-month period of time that a year and a half earlier I had been reprimanded by the board for smoking marijuana in the Chancellor's residence.
Mm-hmm. And
so, yes, go ahead. Sorry.
And how in 2006 was that such a big deal?
Well, it's a pretty big deal. Anyway, I mean, it is. It's certainly is still illegal in mm-hmm. Tennessee, both even for medical purposes. What had happened was that I had come down with Meniere's disease, which is a debilitating disease of the inner ear, and I was very, very ill. And I was throwing up with vertigo every day, and a friend of mine brought me a small amount of marijuana and a pipe, and it helped enormously with nausea, as I'm sure that some of your listeners have experienced. And so I would smoke it from time to time to help with that. But I was ratted out by one of the house staff.
Oh my!
And to the board, yes, it's one of those. And I was reprimanded for smoking it. And but by that time, I had had two operations, and I was doing better with the Meniere's. So anyway, that was a long time. That was a year and a half before this article came out. But basically, that was about the juiciest thing, I think, that the reporters could find. And so the headline of the article was Vanderbilt reigns in lavish spending of star chancellor. Mm-hmm. And then the subheading was marijuana at the mansion.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that helps sell some papers.
Yeah, and I did go back and look at the article, and interestingly enough, they never mentioned the word Meniere's disease. Is that correct?
That is correct. They talked about that I used marijuana for an inner ear ailment, as if I had an earache or something.
Right.
So, yes, no, they never bothered to talk about Meniere's disease.
Right, and if they had used the word Meniere's disease, they'd have to put some sort of a symptoms and treatment. And of course, the treatment is very even in 2006. There's been some breakthroughs very recently. But because I Googled it, and yes, there are people who get some relief from some of the symptoms by using marijuana. And this would have probably not made it as juicy. So journalism was not as clean as it was even in 2006.
No, well, you know, it is true. I mean, marijuana, I mean, I'm sure many of the people that are listening to this, I mean, they use it socially, which is, something that we have to be careful about. I have to keep reminding myself of because of the way that I was raised. I'm very old compared to your listeners. I'm getting ready to turn 59 years old. So when I was a teenager, it was, if you were going to smoke any pot, you did it very clandestinely. And, and even now, I mean, that is sort of the way that most people or a lot of people still smoke marijuana.
Right.
But one thing that I think I have to keep reminding myself because of just the way I was raised with, oh, my God, be careful and stuff and, you know.
Right.
What is that there is really nothing wrong with smoking marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as long as you think that it's okay, if you think it's okay to have a glass of wine, then it's okay to have a little, to have some pot, to smoke a little pot. Now, anything can be abused. There is no doubt about that.
Sure.
But there is, it certainly is less harmful than both alcohol and tobacco, which are both legal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm sort of getting off the subject here, but I mean, I think it's important to, why was it so juicy? Why did it cause such a big to-do? Well, one, I was the chancellor's wife, and it was pretty scandalous, especially the way it was reported. But, something that we need to remember as a country, as individuals, is really smoke. There's nothing terrible about smoking pot, and certainly not for medical purposes. And it helps in many ways. There's many different symptoms that marijuana helps a great deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so what? Even if you want to smoke it socially, truly, there's really nothing wrong with that either.
Right.
We're not criminals.
No. Actually, I didn't share this with you during our little chat, is that I'm a cancer survivor of a stage 3 cancer. In 1996, I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which had spread to several places, and I was in severe treatment. And I did use marijuana for about 8-9 months for the nausea and treatment, probably enough so that I would not have to take some of the other stronger drugs, and also that I could eat and keep my strength up. So I'm, you know, of course, I'm a firm believer that there are medical uses for marijuana as well as the social uses. I've never felt that when I was doing this that I was breaking the law, because I was so ill and I felt, I'm going to die. Who cares if people find out? But yes, I do understand personally exactly the desperation when you have a symptom that cannot go away with anything else. Of course, an illegal substance, big deal. You know, you almost say, you know, this is more important to my life and to my well-being than breaking some law in some book somewhere. I want to get back to why they had done this investigation on your former husband, Gordon Gee. You mentioned the Sarbanes-Oxley Law. I was chair of a national nonprofit, and I looked at some of the numbers that the university spent per year. In fact, I think you spent lavish amounts of money entertaining at Braeburn. Braeburn, the name of the chancellor's residence, $700,000 a year is what the article was quoted. But you raised $1.2 billion in the 5 or 6 years that you were spending that kind of money. If he were a businessman investing that money and getting that kind of return, he would have been a genius. People would have been throwing more money at him. But because it's a nonprofit, you have this idea that you can't spend any money to make money, and it's absolutely ridiculous. And I think, was that the real reason that they did the investigation?
Well, first of all, really, universities are not nonprofits. I think that the medical centers certainly make quite a bit of money, and he was one, if not the highest, right within like one or two up the highest paid university presidents in the country.
Right.
So he was a lightning rod, very, very visible, very much of a spokesperson for higher education, also,
right.
You know, had an enormous salary. And we lived in a huge, beautiful home that was renovated at great expense when we got there, not because we asked them to do it, but because they wanted us to live in the house, and it hadn't been really lived in for about 18 years, so it needed a lot of work.
Right.
But when we had it renovated, and it was beautiful, the reason we lived there is so we could entertain there, because you can raise a lot of money. People like to come to your house.
Correct.
You know, they'd rather, major donors would much rather come to the university president's house some place on campus. They want to feel like they're a part of something intimate. And we went out of our way to do that, and we entertained unrelentingly. We invited in, everybody, town and gown and people from all over the country. We entertained, 5-6 days a week.
Wow.
And so, we did it beautifully, and people loved to come to the house, and it was really quite an amazing, it was very elegant. And yes, it takes a lot of money to entertain that well and to have dinners for 200 people cocktail parties for 200 people and sit-down dinners for 100. And, you know, it takes a lot of money to entertain that way. But on the other hand, yes, we raised $1.25 billion over the course of 5 years. So I think that's another reason that the Wall Street Journal didn't have much, there wasn't much they could criticize, because anybody that reads the Wall Street Journal is going to say, that's a pretty good return on the investment.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And let me talk a little bit about the South. You're from North Carolina. You've lived all over, but you were living in Nashville. What was it like to be, you know, to live in the South, in Nashville at that period of time, even though it was a liberal university, tell us about some of the rules that you had to live under being a Southern First Lady.
Well, I don't know if there's like rules per se. Maybe there should have been. Maybe if they had to like laid out the rules for me, I would have been better about not breaking them. But I can't seem to be like, I kept breaking them, which was one of them was to be, I was rather outspoken in my political views, which were much more liberal than they probably ought to have been in that place and time. That was probably what got me into the most trouble was how I felt about about the Bush administration, about the Iraqi war, about Condoleezza Rice, about some of those things. And and it became public knowledge, and I think I began to stack up a few unhappy trustees in my wake in that. But Nashville is a very cool city. The music industry, the music that you can hear night and day, it's just, it is a wonderful place. And
great.
So I really, you know, when I first, when we were first going to move there, I didn't want to move there. We were at Brown University. We were at Ohio State. That's where I met Gordon. And then we went to Brown, and I really, really loved Providence. And I love New England. In fact, I just have moved back here. And my politics were nothing, nobody raised an eyebrow about my liberal politics up here. But when I went back, when we went down to Tennessee, and being at Vanderbilt, which is a very conservative school politically, I knew I was probably... it was probably going to be difficult, and it was difficult for me.
What
I
about
can't keep my mouth shut.
What about the other faculty wives? How did you get along with them?
What about, I'm sorry, the other faculty?
I'm sorry, the other faculty wives? The other faculty wives, even though you were a professor, you still had to kind of deal with, you know, the heads of departments and things like that. Did you get along with them okay?
Well, I did until... for the most part, yeah, until Gordon left. One thing about being married to the president of a major university is that you really, it's very difficult to have friends among the faculty, even if you're on the faculty yourself.
Right, and you were a tenured professor there, right?
I was, yes. I was a professor and taught public policy and public policy in the arts. And, you know, I mean, I had friends, but it's, I think it's just very difficult. People, it's hard to trust people. It's hard to get close, intimate with people with, you know, too much gossip. Better to make your friends outside of the university is what I found.
Well, especially since a House staff member outed you to the Wall Street Journal or to the trustees, excuse me. You know, so that, yeah, there were, it was hard to make friends, probably. Let's go ahead and get to the legalization of marijuana, which has been in the news, especially since Tuesday, November the 6th, with two states now two more states now legalizing marijuana, Washington State and Colorado, and all of the subtext that go with that. What were your feelings when you heard those two states had legalized it?
Yahoo!
Right.
Yahoo! I'm so proud of them. Good for them.
Right.
And I think it's a really huge deal. I think we have, I may be wrong on this, but I think there are 18 states now that have medical marijuana, Massachusetts being one of the most recent that just passed it. Just a couple weeks ago, and I just moved up here, and I got to vote for it. I was
good for you.
Very happy to cast that ballot.
Right.
And would have voted for full legalization, of course, but we didn't have that option.
Right.
But you know, the fact that it is now fully legal in Colorado and in Washington is it's a pretty big deal.
Right.
Because basically, what the states and the localities are saying to the federal government is, we're not going to spend our time and resources arresting people for small amounts of marijuana.
Right.
It is now legal. And it's the federal government has depended on localities and the states to implement their draconian drug laws.
Right.
So this is huge, and
right.
it will be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and what's the next step? You know, how is it going to be distributed? Where, I mean, the medical marijuana has a system of distribution that is pretty. It's hit or miss, but there is a system. But now that it is legal in those two states, you know, how is that going to happen? Are the feds going to come in? Do we know?
I certainly don't. I'm not privy to that. I'm not that
right.
up on marijuana
right.
law
uh-huh.
to be able to say. But you know, frankly, I think it's going to be easier to regulate it with. As being fully legalized
sure.
than it is medicinally, because
sure.
let's face it, a lot of people that don't really need it medically
mm-hmm.
can get a doctor. I mean, you
oh,
know, it
sure.
depends on the state. You know, I mean, California is a good example of where it just kind of, you know, there are a lot of dispensaries and there are probably
sure.
a lot of people that, you know, have medical marijuana cards and, you
right.
know, they're just using it socially and I don't really, that's okay with me. But, you know,
sure.
I think it's much more difficult to only do it halfway like that because
sure.
there's just so many loopholes. Where if you
right.
just legalize it, well, I mean, we've got lots of models. I mean, alcohol,
right.
you know, tobacco.
Right.
I mean, there's a saying that, you know, if you really care, you know, of course people are worried about children getting, you know, getting more access to marijuana, but if it's legal and it's regulated,
right.
they'll probably have less access because it'll be
right.
off the street corner and behind the counter.
Sure, and
it's
you're going to have
adults. It's much easier for young people. Yeah, right. it's much easier for young people to get a hold of marijuana than it is for them to get a hold of a bottle of booze.
Exactly, that's the case. That is the case all over the country. Is that, you know, you can get easier to get meth than it is to get a six pack. You know, because it is right there, and people do what they realize is it's also a revenue source. You know, we're talking about a taxation issue, a regulation issue. Some of the quality, sometimes, you know, things that you're buying on the street could be so polluted and, you know, have, you know, poisons and toxins in them. And so, you know, if this were a regulated national industry, which of course it isn't yet, I believe it's going to be someday, like gay marriage. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, if they would just wake up and realize it's a revenue source and B, an incredible amount of resources, physical and monetary, are spent in every single state arresting, trying, convicting, and incarcerating people for relatively small amounts of marijuana. The people with large amounts of marijuana, they never catch those. You know, it seems
right.
like, it's really sad. It's a very sad situation.
It's more than sad. It's tragic. And in the fallout for our country, over 800,000 people are arrested every year for marijuana charges, about 89% of those for simple possession with less than an
right.
ounce.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what we are doing to our young people, we'd better put them in jail than keep them in school. What we were doing to our young people, and especially minorities who are, you know, by and large, the majority of people that are arrested for possession
right.
of marijuana, it is a national tragedy what we're doing. But, you know, there's so many vested interests against it. I mean, people know that it would be, to regulate it would be smart in so many mm-hmm. ways, but there are many vested interests. I mean, the Drug Enforcement, the Drug Enforcement Agency, the feds.
Right.
I mean, you know, a lot of how they make their budget is by marijuana arrest and
exactly.
drug arrest. I mean,
exactly.
It's so and right,
right.
And then of course, you know, the big pharmaceutical companies. I mean,
right.
they, you know, they don't want it. It's too cheap. I mean, they don't.
Right.
They don't want
they don't
it legal.
They don't want
the cartels, of course, don't want it legal. I mean, the prison
right.
systems, the for-profit prison systems, they don't want
sure.
it to be legal.
Right.
Those are huge interests.
Right. And there's another huge interest you didn't mention that, of course, we live in Florida with, is drug testing industry. The drug testing industry for marijuana to get a job is monstrous. It's a huge multi-billion-dollar industry mm-hmm. getting yourself tested for marijuana. And that would go away.
No more peeing in a cup, huh?
No more peeing in a cup with those expensive tests. Yes, we have a governor here.
Good Lord.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar. Florida has a draconian, horrid governor who happens to own one of the largest drug testing laboratories in the world, in the United States. And one of the things he wanted to do was everyone on welfare, everyone getting Medicaid, everyone getting food stamps, everyone getting any sort of state or federal assistance living in the state of Florida would have to get a monthly or a bi-monthly test for drugs, and they would have to pay for it themselves.
And it I read about that in the New York Times.
Right, mm-hmm. and then of course it was his business that he was pushing, and we found out when that happened. I had no idea. I've been self-employed, or worked for a small company, so I've never had drug testing. And then I mentioned this to a friend, and all of my friends get drug tested, working for schools, universities, police departments, and you'd be shocked at who. And I ask what they test for. They test for cocaine, marijuana, and amphetamines. And this is a huge business. Another
Definitely the business to buy stock in under this administration.
Oh my God, it's getting worse. But maybe not. Maybe it's getting better. He's got a very low. They ended up. The federal court, they took it to federal court, and it was overturned here. So maybe it won't go through. Okay, let's go back to writing your book, because I have a lot of would-be authors in my audience. They're always asking me the question of, how did you get published? How did you write this book? Tell us a little bit about the mechanics of getting this book to print.
Well, how do you get published? There is something called self-publishing now.
Right.
And I put it out to a few people. I had a couple of pretty well-connected people in New York read it. I had like 5 different people read it. I didn't spend a whole lot of time trying to find a publisher. Each one of them said exactly the same thing. Great story, well written, but we think it's too regional. I hope they're wrong with that. But I spent 3.5 years. I spent 3.5 years writing it, and I was just ready to do it. I had to have it published in order to get it to go on with my life, really. So
right.
I just decided, well, I'm going to self-publish it. But I would caution your listeners that are interested in doing that. Self-publishing is a great option, but it's not inexpensive. And, it's very important to look around and see what's out there. And I think that if there are any good local publishers that are nearby you, instead of finding somebody through the internet and then sort of working, long distance with people, if you can find a good local publisher, I kind of wish I had done this, I'd realized about this, and then you can work with them more directly. You can go down, you can see what the book's going to look like. You can see the blues. I think that would have made it much less stressful for me if I wasn't working long distance with somebody I never ever met and hardly, often didn't get to talk to very often. But self-publishing, yes.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of self-publishing going on, and there's a lot of small regional presses. You're absolutely right. They've kind of cropped up in the last couple of years because the cost of this print on demand has gone down for the regional publishing. That's a very, very good thing. So did you have an agent, or did you just push this yourself?
No, I didn't have an agent. I didn't have to. You mean did I push it myself? I really.
Well, you seem to.
I had a wonderful person, Rosemary Gorman, a wonderful person in Nashville, that helped me with the publicity. The publicity of it in Nashville.
Good.
When it first came out, and I had two wonderful friends that had a great book signing for me, Paul Kuhn and Holly Hoffman. Now, Paul Kuhn is interesting. He is the head of Normal. He's a national chair of Normal.
Cool.
And so that was really a nice connection. But so I was lucky in that I had some friends that helped me, but people really were ready to hear the story. I was telling a story that a lot of people in Nashville are connected with Vanderbilt really
sure.
wanted to hear.
And
so I had
worldwide.
A lot of people show up. Huh?
Right. And it's known worldwide.
Yeah.
Vanderbilt is a world. Listen, we are 10 seconds away from ending. I want to thank you. I know I'm cutting you off. This was so much fun, Constance. Good
you have to.
Luck.
I'll just talk forever.
Good luck with your book, and good night from Fort Lauderdale.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, here we go. End episode. Don't.